Hello and welcome to Democracy North, a weekly podcast of the best interviews, headlines, and music from the Daily Media Morning Show here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, and online at w2media.ca. This weekend, Kitimat had a referendum on the Northern Gateway pipeline, which would terminate there. And in fact, most of the jobs from the pipeline would be located there, apparently. But the city voted 58% against the pipeline. On the show today, we will speak with Kai Nagata, the energy and democracy campaigner with the Dogwood Initiative. And after that, Jasmine Thomas of Sekou's First Nation and a member of the Yinka Dene Alliance on what's next for Northern Gateway.
Last week was the Quebec election, and the surprisingly sweeping defeat of the Parti Québécois. We'll be talking with our regular Media Mornings contributor, Marianne Breton-Fontaine, who we spoke to regularly during the student strike. We'll be talking with Marianne about the implications of that election.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news, from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independent like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
The landscape of change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
and podcasting at w2media.ca.
And stay tuned for this week's top Canadian and global news headlines. In our top story, Ottawa is now expanding its investigation into claims that McDonald's discriminated against Canadian employees in favor of temporary foreign workers who have less access to labor rights, equal pay, or employment benefits, on the same day that two unions have filed a court action challenging the program in another case. As the Vancouver Sun reports, the foreign worker program has faced a barrage of criticism in recent months amid allegations that certain employers are flouting the rules designed to protect Canadian jobs and foreign workers from abuse. The federal government's investigation into McDonald's started with three Victoria restaurants owned by a single franchisee, who allegedly brought in temporary foreign workers when there were qualified locals available to do the job. On Monday, Employment and Social Development Canada announced it is investigating that two other franchises in Parksville and Lethbridge misused the program. They are suspended from bringing in more workers pending the outcome of government's investigation, according to a spokesperson for Employment Minister Jason Kenney.
The suspect in deaths of three people at two Jewish centers in Kansas is to be charged with committing hate crimes, according to investigators. Fraser Glenn Cross, 73, was arrested on Sunday over a shooting spree that killed a teenager and his grandfather outside a Jewish community center in Overland Park, Kansas, and a woman visiting her mother at a nearby Jewish retirement home. The Missouri man has a long, virulent history of anti-Semitism. While police in Overland Park, Kansas, stopped short of labeling the Sunday attacks a hate crime until they were further along in their investigation, the suspect is the founder and former leader of the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan and the White Patriot Party. Both operated as paramilitary organizations in the 1980s, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors hate groups. The 73-year-old Miller faces charges of premeditated first-degree murder. He's expected to appear in court on Monday.
It was a bad weekend for Enbridge, and so it was a good weekend for everyone who doesn't want to see their controversial Northern Gateway pipeline built. According to the Vancouver Observer, a plebiscite held Saturday in Kitimat, where the proposed pipeline would have its terminal. Kitimat residents rejected the Enbridge pipeline, with 58% voting no. Enbridge vowed to continue the project despite rejection of Kitimat voters. It said that, quote, today's result shows that while there is support for Northern Gateway in Kitimat, we have more work to do. But according to Donnie Van Dyke, Northern Gateway's manager of Coastal Aboriginal and Community Relations. However, the NDP House Leader and MP for Skeena Bulkley Valley, Nathan Cullen, said Enbridge should just stop the project altogether. Earlier on Friday, the Yinka Dene Alliance held a gathering to reiterate their unequivocal rejection of Enbridge. Also reported on the Vancouver Observer that 200 people from four Yinka Dene communities packed a gymnasium in North Central BC on Friday to give an emotional presentation to the federal government and Enbridge that their alliance formally opposes the Northern Gateway oil pipeline. Meanwhile, 24 Hours reports that First Nations band Nitanibun near Burns Lake has revoked its support for the Northern Gateway pipeline project, instead is endorsing an alternative pipeline proposal announced Monday by a First Nations-owned company. The Aquilini Group that partnered with the company announced that it has been consulting First Nations for over a year, has 50% support from bands across Northern BC. They did not provide a specific route, but said the idea is to transport synthetic crude rather than bitumen.
On the Lower Mainland, an openly gay Vancouver Park Board commissioner is trying to force the provincial government to revoke the accreditation for segregated law school planned for Langley's Trinity Western University. Trevor Loke filed a petition in BC Supreme Court on Monday after Minister of Advanced Education, Emmerick Virk, approved the private Christian university's new school, which bans homosexual activity among students and faculty. Loke claims the minister's decision fosters a discriminatory policy that violates his rights under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
And in foreign affairs news, the Canadian government promoted it as the largest advanced manufacturing export win in the country's history. But according to Al Jazeera, the deal announced February between Canada and Saudi Arabia will see Canada's division of General Dynamics Land Systems build more than $10 billion worth of light armored vehicles and associated equipment for Saudi Arabia. Canadian Minister of International Trade Ed Fast touted the landmark contract as a way to benefit hundreds of local supply firms and create thousands of advanced manufacturing jobs, particularly in the populous region of southern Ontario. But critics contend the Saudi deal represents a dangerous escalation in Canada's willingness to supply military equipment to repressive regimes, and lack of regard for what impact the equipment could have on the ground, particularly in light of new reporting showing that Saudi Arabia leads the Middle East in military spending. Over to Russia, where pro-Russian separatists ignored an ultimatum to leave occupied government buildings in eastern Ukraine and instead seized more buildings as Kiev failed to follow through on a threatened military crackdown. As Al Jazeera reports, the armed separatists remained in control of government offices in at least nine eastern towns that Ukraine as of last night and stormed a police station in Horliva despite warnings from Kiev of a military response if they did not withdraw by 6 a.m. In a telephone conversation on Monday, U.S. President Barack Obama urged his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, to press pro-Moscow groups to lay down their weapons and leave the seized buildings. The U.S. has accused Russia of orchestrating an ongoing separatist violence throughout Ukraine, as said it was preparing full-scale operation against pro-Russian forces, which have overrun municipalities in several eastern cities. A U.S. representative told an emergency meeting of the U.N. Security Council on Monday that the seizure of buildings in several of the country's eastern cities mirrored Russia's previous invasion of Crimea. But Russia, which called the meeting, said it was the West who will determine the opportunity to stop the civil war in the Ukraine. The emergency session was the 10th round of talks on the crisis and came after Kiev threatened to launch military operations.
Ukraine's military has suffered a humiliating setback in the east as pro-Russian gunmen occupy several government buildings. Now that includes the city council hall in Donetsk. For days, Kiev has vowed to restore its authority over the region, but so far has failed to do so. Well, the crisis has prompted world leaders to gather in Geneva to try to find a solution. Representatives from the U.S., the European Union, Russia and Ukraine are meeting. Nick Spicer reports.
Well, their talking positions are as far apart as their version of reality on the ground in Ukraine. We just heard the Ukrainian foreign minister accusing Russia of fomenting problems, sending in what the Ukrainians call green men, which is to say Russian special forces not wearing national insignia, to stir up trouble in southeastern Ukraine, essentially using the template that Moscow used to take over the peninsula of Crimea, which was part of Ukraine until recently.
Lots more on all those stories and a lot more at the Al Jazeera website, aljazeera.com.
Libya's Coast Guard has detained more than 400 immigrants, mostly from the Horn of Africa, in its waters in the past 2 days after they tried to cross to Europe in small boats, Libyan officials say. The Coast Guard picked up five boatloads of people. Warning shots were fired at several vessels and 78 people were rescued from a sinking ship. Kassem Ayoub, a Libyan Navy spokesman, reported, The Deputy Commissioner of Naval Operations, Mohammed Al-Bati, said on Thursday his office received information on Tuesday that a boatload of people would attempt the journey to Italy. Most of those taken into custody came from Somalia and Eritrea, and a handful were from Ghana and Nigeria. Some are held at a Tripoli police station and are being examined by a United Nations medical team. Many migrants are from sub-Saharan Africa head to North Africa to escape from desperate conditions in their own countries, hoping to find work there or risk the perilous journey to Europe. Italy alone rescued 4,000 migrants from boats trying to reach European shores in early April. At that point, 15,000 migrants had already arrived there by sea since the start of the year.
Over to China, where a Beijing court has upheld a four-year prison term for a prominent Chinese legal activist for supporting anti-corruption protests. According to Al Jazeera, the decision drew criticism and calls for his release from rights groups. The prosecution of Xu Zhiyong and others in his closely knit New Citizens grassroots movement were part of a clampdown by authorities on any movement that could challenge the Communist Party's monopoly on power. The Beijing Supreme Court on Friday ruled that the lower trial court verdict in January was correct in finding Xu guilty of gathering crowds to disturb public order and sentenced him to 4 years in prison. The 40-year-old said the, quote, absurd judgment cannot halt the tide of human progress. China has put Zhu and 10 other members of the movement on trial this year, and Amnesty International called the rejection of his appeal an affront to justice, calling for his release. Zhu's prosecution is part of a deepening pattern of arrests of lawyers, activists, journalists, and religious leaders who challenge Chinese policies and actions. Zhu's criminal defense largely stemmed from several rallies he organized in front of the education ministry to demand equal education rights. The group members argue the rallies did not display any public business nor create any disorder.
Vindication was the word on the winner's lips yesterday as the news organizations at the forefront of the widening NSA scandal collected the most coveted prize in American journalism. But as the Toronto Star reports for whistleblower Edward Snowden, the amour of the Pulitzer for public service may not be enough to ease a lifetime on the run. Snowden, the former federal security contractor, now 8 months into self-imposed exile in Russia, was not named by the Pulitzer Committee at 3 p.m. Monday as the winners were unveiled, but as the teams of The Guardian and Washington Post journalists, who dedicated months to unraveling the extent of NSA surveillance secrets handed over by Snowden, made clear, much of the credit belongs to their singular source. Guardian editor Alan Rusbriger hailed the award as a powerful message about the act of public service that began with an intelligence insider whom many Americans now regard as a traitor.
And finally, in the environment news, the killing of activists protecting their land rights and the environment has surged over the past decade, with nearly three times as many deaths in 2012 than 10 years previously, according to a new report. As The Guardian reports, Deadly Environment, an investigation by the London-based Global Witness, documents 147 recorded deaths in 2012, compared with only 51 in 2002. Between those years, at least 908 activists have been killed in 35 countries, with only 10 convictions for their deaths. The death rate has risen in past 4 years to an average of two activists a week, according to the report, which also documents 17 forced disappearances, all of whom are presumed dead. Brazil, the report found, is the world's most deadly country for communities defending natural resources, with 448 deaths between 2002 and 2013, followed by 109 in Honduras and Peru, with 58. In Asia, the Philippines is the deadliest, with 67, followed by Thailand at 16. In Honduras, the second most dangerous country, 93 peasant farmers in the fertile Bajo Aguan region have been murdered since 2012 amidst land conflicts with agribusiness. The insatiable global appetite for gold, silver, and other minerals is powering extractive industries in countries with weak institutions and is linked to at least 150 deaths since 2002, many of them linked to Canadian-owned mining companies, many of them headquartered here in Vancouver. Well, that's our news. Well, that's our news for this week. You're listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca/thisweek, on CHLY Radio Nanaimo, on the Rabble Podcast Network, and on iTunes. I'm David Ball, your host for this week. On the phone with us, we have Kai Nagata. He is Energy and Democracy Director with the Dogwood Initiative, and he's here to talk to us about the no vote that Kitimat gave to the Enbridge pipeline this weekend. Good morning, Kai.
Good morning, David.
Welcome back to Media Mornings. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's fantastic always to have you here. And I forget what we had you on about last time, but it was one, I think, one of your deprogram videos that you did. So now you've got a job with the Dogwood, and you're right here to talk to us about the Kitimat vote. Tell me what happened this weekend and why it's so significant.
Well, I think we saw what happens when you give people the chance to vote on this project. And in this case, this is in a community that had everything to gain from the Northern Gateway Pipeline, permanent jobs, and $5 million in tax revenue. And they decided the risks weren't worth it. And this isn't a place where Enbridge had no spending limits in the campaign, and they have spent 10 years trying to buy a social license. They have an office there. They flew in their senior executives. They blanketed the region with ads. And they still lost.
The I saw some videos of like door knockers at people's doors, like really trying to convince them of everything.
Yeah, they had a ground game. They had 12 canvassers that they flew in from Calgary who were going around to houses, and apparently they hit pretty much every house in town. And, you know, they adopted all of the same tactics and techniques that you might if you were a candidate seeking election, except this is a company trying to put a pipeline through the town. And they lost. The people of Kitimat delivered their decision. And while it might be symbolic, I think this is a turning point in the overall campaign.
It was 58%, I understand.
Yeah, just over.
Now, the town of Kitimat isn't very large, as I understand it. It's how many people live there? Like,
it's a community of about 9,000, I think. Mm-hmm. Just over 3,000 voted, and 600 or 700 of those were new voters. So it's not clear how many of those people came from the work camps. But I have a friend who's a construction worker there right now, and he was not eligible to vote because he hadn't been there for 30 days. But if you'd been there for 30 days, you were eligible to vote in this plebiscite.
Interesting. So people who are working in, there's of course a huge energy infrastructure that's already existing there with a, I think there's an Alcan plant and there's a number of other facilities.
Yeah, Rio Tinto is upgrading. They're doing the Kitimat modernization project right now. So it's a huge, huge construction site modernizing the aluminum smelter.
Did you actually get up to Kitimat during the referendum?
No, and I'll tell you why. We talked to some of the folks at Douglas Channel Watch who were working on this on the ground. And we had people calling us and asking, you know, I'll fly from Kamloops to Terrace, I'll rent a car, I'll drive down, I'll help them door knock. And what we heard from people who were actually doing the work on the ground was that it just doesn't work to have outsiders show up and tell people what to do in their own community. And that's what Enbridge did. They brought high-paid people in from Calgary to try to tell, you know, these poor blue-collar bumpkins in this northern town how much, you know, they would stand to benefit from this, and they tried to twist people's arms. People resented it. So having a bunch of environmentalists or campaigners, you know, show up from southern BC or who knows where and try to walk around talking to people about their hopes and dreams for Kitimat, it just didn't seem helpful. That's not my community, and it's not my family, it's not where I live, so it didn't seem like it made any sense to go up there and actually try to have any kind of meaningful conversations with people about their decision they were going to make. So we stayed out of it.
What do you think about Enbridge saying now that they basically have more work to do, that they're not ready to give up on this in spite of the no vote?
Yeah, their response was that, well, you know, at least 40% of people who voted seems to like our proposal.
It's good enough for them.
40% doesn't cut it in a democracy.
I don't know. The federal conservatives got in with 25%.
No, as soon as I said that, I realized.
In a democracy. But, I mean, it is interesting. Enbridge basically saying that they will not take no for an answer. They're just going to keep pushing until that, you know, they buy enough ads to raise that.
Well, yeah. I mean, what else are they going to do? They can't just walk away now that they've invested so much money and pride. But I think at this point, these are sunk costs. And that's why we've floated the idea of pushing for a vote as a province, because the province has jurisdiction over these utility permits, 60 permits for things like electricity and water that are necessary to actually get the pipeline built and operating. And if the province withholds its support for the project, as the premier has said since 2012, it will not be built. And we know that we're the majority. We know that people in BC, especially people who oppose this project, are far more motivated and numerous than people who are fans of it. And so if they couldn't get a yes vote in Kitimat after pouring all that money in for the last 10 years trying to convince people that this is in their best interest, how could they possibly hope to win in a citizens initiative when there's a $5,000 spending limit?
Do you think that that's what it's going to take to actually kill this once and for all, is a province-wide vote?
I think there's a number of things that have to happen to easier phrasing, kill it once and for all. And I think that all of these pistons have to be firing at the same time. So the first thing is the leadership that we've seen from the nations along the pipeline route and affected by the oil tankers. So we've got 130 First Nations that have stood up as governments and said no. And in places where there's no treaties and where consultation hasn't taken place and consent hasn't been given, that carries a great deal of legal weight. However, do we want to wait and watch this go behind closed doors in a courtroom for years and years and cost millions of dollars? You know, those court cases are risky, too, in that if you lose, if a particular nation doesn't have the strongest claim, then that money could conceivably have to be paid back if they lose an appeal to the federal government and the energy industry and all the interveners in between. And so it's an enormous financial risk for a small community to take on like that. And if we can avoid that in any possible way through a political solution, then I think that's the best outcome for everybody. So we're talking about changing our laws and our political system to reflect the indigenous laws and the declarations already in place from those 130 nations. And that's what I think our responsibility is as people who don't hold Aboriginal or treaty rights.
We'll be hearing from Jackie Thomas of the Yinkadine Alliance after this. But Kai, we've had some analysts on our show before, as well as we've seen in the mainstream media, saying that the Northern Gateway is dead. You keep hearing this. They say Kinder Morgan's a better shot at it. They say that LNG is pretty much a shoo-in with the Premier's heavy endorsement. But it seems like the company's still spending money, and they wouldn't be doing so. I wondered if you had any thoughts on how much they've actually spent on ads. It seems like everywhere you turn, there's a TV or radio ad about Enbridge assuring you that Janet Holder thinks it's safe. And, but it seems like they don't think it's dead. If that's the case, why would they keep pumping money into this?
Well, you have to understand that money doesn't come from their investors. That money comes from the three giant oil companies in China that are backing this project, and from the shippers who, you know, to 10 of the world's biggest oil companies, a few million bucks in advertising and the regulatory process, it's chump change. You know, they ponied up years ago when they signed on for a share of the shipping capacity. They all forked over a few million bucks, and that's the war chest that Enbridge has been dipping into to run this campaign. So for all intents and purposes, their money is unlimited and it has no bearing on their valuation as a company or on their investors. And so they're free to spend it however they like, and they're going to go to the wall. The opportunity we have in front of us is in the federal decision that has not been made. And it's funny because some people say it's dead and they sort of wave their hand and say, okay, Enbridge is dead. And then you talk to other people who say Enbridge is inevitable. And I think that's deeply defeatist and unhelpful for people to say, yeah, I oppose the project, but it's just going to happen anyway. And the fact is that Stephen Harper hasn't made a decision on this. And Stephen Harper is a political tactician who makes decisions not based on any particular set of economic principles or even consistency with his past actions. He makes decisions based on whether they're going to lose him seats. And so when you look at Northern Gateway and you look at the opposition and the depth of the opposition in BC, Stephen Harper has more than 20 seats that he has to protect if he wants to form a majority government in 2015. And what he'll do is hang this albatross around the necks of all those campaigners and all those candidates across the province who want to seek re-election under the Conservative Party brand, because they're the only political party that supports this project. And if he ignites this kind of political firestorm by pushing this through, his candidates will go down in the next election. And that's something he has to take into consideration. So he's making that decision, and we don't hear a lot of people talking about it because they've all assumed that it's inevitable.
Well, the Globe and Mail, actually, in their review of the Kitimat vote, noted that Kitimat is kind of a bit of a conservative heartland in terms of speaking to its economic base, long-term blue-collar jobs, industry. Likewise, there's a number of landowners who are really upset across BC about having expropriations from these various pipelines and feeling like they're, you know, being silenced by Enbridge signing contracts, not disclose the offers being made to them, that kind of thing. These are not left wing voters. Do you think that's going to affect the conservative calculation here?
That's the only thing that will. It's the loss of their own vote, and so it's not a bunch of white lefty activists who stopped the Keystone Pipeline thus far. It was Republican ranchers The people who've actually taken the state to court and slowed down the approval process on Keystone are the alliance that calls themselves the Cowboys and Indians. People like Randy, Stand with Randy in Nebraska. These are not liberal people. These are not big city latte sippers, as the conservative stereotypes would have it. These are people who are basically a captive vote for the Republican Party, the Conservative Party, and cannot stand on principle the actions of the government. And so I would say we got to look to the examples of where these kinds of struggles have been successful in the past and look at the kind of alliances that have to be formed and stop making assumptions about people who hold conservative ideals or live in rural places.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Kai. Any final thoughts before we have to let you go today?
Well, I just I think that in a democracy, we have to assert our decision-making power and use it or lose it principle. And so sitting back and saying, oh, the First Nations will save us, or, oh, you know, we'll just have to leave this up to our elected representatives, it's not true. Politicians are followers. They're not leaders. And so we have to give them a mandate to do the right thing. And if they still betray the will of the majority, then we have to be ready to take that on. And that's why we're suggesting Citizens Initiative, and that's why we launched LetBCVote.ca.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Kai. Always a pleasure to have you on here.
Thanks, David.
Thanks. Have a great day. That was Kai Nagata. He is Energy and Democracy Director at the Dogwood Initiative. And we're going to have a song before we come back with Jackie Thomas of the Yinka Dene Alliance to talk about the Kitimat vote, its future of Enbridge, as well as a historic meeting that happened this past weekend by First Nations opposed to the project. You're listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca/thisweek, on CHLY Radio Nanaimo, on the Rabble Podcast Network, and on iTunes. I'm David Ball, your host for this week. Joining us on the phone line, we have Jasmine Thomas. She is with Tsikas First Nation, which is a member of the Yinka Dene Alliance. We mentioned that in our interview with Kai Nagata just now, who have expressed a wall of opposition to the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline. Good morning, Jasmine. Welcome to our show.
Good morning, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks so much for agreeing to come on. And I wondered if we can just first off start by, you know, hearing some of your thoughts about the Kitimat vote, the town which would have gained a number of full-time, long-term jobs from the pipeline actually said no itself.
I think it was a great victory for many people in British Columbia, but also across Canada. We've been working, many people, First Nations, non-First Nations, together for many years, and I think this is an expression of the solidarity that has been shown across this country. It's been amazing.
We've had Yinka Dene on before. I had Jackie on once a year ago, and also Geraldine, but glad to have you as well. You mentioned last night when we were talking about a gathering that happened on the weekend. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about what happened at the gathering, what it was for, and what came out of it.
Oh, so I will just a little bit of background. When Enbridge came around first in 2005, our community started to look at the details of the project. And after discussions with our communities, direction was given by elders and leaders that the Enbridge pipeline could not go through our territories. So we then spearheaded the Save the Fraser Declaration in 2010 to express our legal ban on Enbridge, which has been signed over 130 First Nations communities from the Arctic Ocean to the U.S. today. So the Save the Fraser Declaration is an expression of our law, but it's not where our law comes from. We live our law. So the gathering on Friday that was held in Nacazli was very important to our people for two reasons. First, the act of our leaders and elders giving the formal reasons for our Enbridge ban in a gathering according to our laws, witnessed by our clan representatives, affirms for our people that this decision is legally binding on us and that we must ensure that the Enbridge ban is respected and enforced. It is part of living our law. And second, it was important to have Canada there, who we invited to witness the reasons upholding our ban on Enbridge, and to understand that this decision is made according to our laws and is binding on us. So Canada previously refused to sit down with us face-to-face to discuss our ban on the Enbridge pipeline, saying instead that we needed to appear before the Joint Review Panel. So the Joint Review Panel had no mechanism to address or incorporate our laws, and so we decided that it was not appropriate to make submissions to the JRP. Instead, we submitted expert reports and arguments to Canada directly. So in the afternoon on Friday's gathering, we hired the panel of federal officials, according to our laws, in our potlatch or batlat system, as our clan members each contributed to a gift that was presented to the federal officials to recognize them for hearing our legal ban on Enbridge and for their obligation to carry that message to Ottawa and to Stephen Harper.
Now, you mentioned, you know, going to Canada directly and not the JRP. Is that because perhaps you don't recognize the JRP as a legitimate, say, negotiating partner in terms of nation to nation? Is that part of that?
Part of the reason we've been asking for a separate First Nations review process that actually incorporates our laws and, you know, considers Aboriginal rights and title, but also the cumulative effects such as, you know, increasing tar sands and also the impacts to our climate. So those weren't recognized, which is why we chose to step out of it. But we do applaud all those who did participate in it in record numbers. So.
What do you think is next for Enbridge? We were just talking with the Dogwood just now about that, and you know, there's some people who say that the project is dead, and you know, it's clearly got a lot of opposition, but they keep spending money on advertising, so it seems like they're really keen to keep going with this.
I think they also recognize that this this battle isn't over. You know, once the JRP recommendation came out, there are some people out there who felt almost like, is this it? Is this the end? But no, it's just a part of the whole process, because Canada's going to be making their decision in June, Enbridge recognizing that, which I see why they want to amp up their media campaign or door-to-door efforts. But I think it doesn't even end there. Like we said, our laws are binding on us, and you know, we've said from day one that we will be there and making sure that this project never goes through.
You've described that as an unbroken wall in previous Yingandane releases, and I'm wondering, you know, talking about Indigenous law, for some of our listeners who might not know what that is or how that applies to people who are not Indigenous, what is Indigenous law? What would your laws say about, you know, how to consult or how people should be engaged as a community when a project is really controversial like this?
Well, for one, Canada doesn't recognize our hereditary leadership. You know, many communities are still in the process of, you know, decolonization, and there's still a lot of band council elected representatives, but there are communities working towards working together on both systems. So what we see is two different systems of law when you look at Canada. You have Canadian law and you have Indigenous law. And Indigenous law is based on the foundation that, you know, everything has a life and it's a reciprocal relationship. And, you know, if we take care of our Mother Earth, it'll take care of us. And if we destroy it, we'll destroy ourselves. And that is the foundation of our laws. And Canada, you know, we've been asking for day one to sit with us at the same table, but Friday's gathering was a start to seeing that happen.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jasmine. It's a pleasure to have you on here. Thank you. This is Jasmine Thomas. She's with Saikaz First Nation and the Yingandane Alliance. You're listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca/thisweek, on CHLY Radio Nanaimo, on the Rabble Podcast Network, and on iTunes.
Last week, the Quebec Liberal Party, under Philippe Couillard, won a majority government of 70 seats, while the incumbent Parti Québécois finished second with 30 seats, becoming the first single-term government since Jean-Jacques Vautrin's Union Nationale government was defeated in 1970. It marks the lowest seat total for the Parti Québécois since 1989 and its smallest share of the popular vote since its inaugural run in 1970, as Premier Pauline Marois lost her own riding. The Coalition Avenir Québec under François Legault made minor gains in terms of seats despite receiving a smaller share of the popular vote than in previous elections. Québec Solidaire, whose vote rose to 7.63%, won an additional seat, with Manon Mazet joining Amir Kadir and Françoise David. To discuss the meaning of these results, we have Marion Breton-Fontaine, a Quebec Solidaire candidate in the 2012 election, a student activist and contributor to Media Mornings and Jeunesse Militante.
It's great to have you on our show again.
Thank you to invite me.
Yeah. So the Quebec election last week, were you surprised at the outcome?
Well, like many people, I was surprised to see a so big majority of Liberals. I was expecting a minority government. So, yes, I think everybody was surprised that day.
So what are your thoughts on the reasons for the PQ defeat?
Well, there is many, I think, aspects to that defeat. We know that a lot of commentators have said that this is the end of the Souverainist option. I don't think that's true. It's funny because it's mainly what we hear from Federalists or people from English Canada. But in Quebec, the analysis is a little bit different. We know that right now there is the context of the election itself. With the PQ trying on one hand to shift its nationalist options towards not a referendum or sovereignty, but towards more identity of, with the Charter of Values and something that a lot of Quebecers were not comfortable with. And on the other hand, saying to its membership, you need to vote for us, you need to continue to support the PQ for the Souverainist option, but then on camera saying, no, we won't do a referendum, et cetera, et cetera. Because basically the PQ did want to be elected not on the referendum question, but on the question of being a good government. Because the truth is that right now, the Constitution of Canada is illegal, it's an unequal partnership between a lot of nations in Canada. So the sovereignty question will never be dead, because there is an injustice still there, and not only for Quebecers, but for Aboriginal nations, Acadians, other communities across Canada. So this will never be a question that will be evacuated until the Constitution is reformed. But on the other hand, it's not mean that separation is something that people want to talk about right now in the context of the economic crisis, of a lot of concern about the health system, about environment. People had other things in their mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The media in English Canada also has said that it was a defeat for the Charter of Values. Is that your impression there?
Yeah, I think this is true. Absolutely. I think, yes, there was a lot of support for the Charter of Values into the Francophone, mainly outside of big centers. But in the same time, they support more and more the debate continue, more and more people feeling comfortable with things that were said. And at the end of the campaign, for example, Jeannette Bertrand made an intervention that was obviously quite racist and not making so much sense, saying that she was afraid that her poll would be forbidden for women because of some hypothetic Muslim men coming and making demands on the landlord. We saw an hypothetical crisis here. And also, people that were maybe supporting the idea of having more laïcité, in terms of vision of not seeing religious signs, maybe were comfortable with that. But then they say comfortable when the government start to say they will lay off women that will not take off their veil. So that create a situation where maybe the support that was stronger at the beginning when this charter was put off, more and more people on iOS as the content of it were feeling more and more uncomfortable with it. So people were not going to vote for the PQ for it. But certainly the people that were maybe in support of the charter a couple months ago were now a bit cold with it, with the recent intervention of the PQ on it. But also that the people that we were really against the charter from the beginning were not going to vote for the PQ and certainly were really campaigning against it because they saw it as taking away rights. Maybe where for didn't think necessarily that was their first question and importance for them, and maybe were not necessarily sovereignist either. So that's the reason their support to the charter didn't transform into a vote for the PQ.
So the other thing that is considered out here to have been fairly decisive, and I'd like to get your analysis of it, was the role that Pierre Carl Perlodeau made in the campaign in terms of the PQ campaign.
Well, I think maybe some commentator thought that Pierre Cardo was had a huge impact in the campaign, but I think Pierre Cardo basically put more, let's say, an image on some malaise that were already present. Of course, for the left of the PQ, seeing Pierre Cardo was a kind of action that the PQ was doing, taking the trend not for social democracy, but more towards like arriving policies. I mean, Pierre Carl Perlodeau is well known for this anti-unions behavior. It's, if it's not the worst patron of all Quebec, he's certainly one of them. As that said, did a series of lockout. So for people from union becoming coming in the public space and say yes, we support Pierre Carl Perlodeau, it was probably hard, very difficult for them, outbreaking. But on the other sense, so for Pierre Perlodeau to rely those left from the PQ was to say, I'm for the separation of Quebec, I'm for sovereignty. And so by saying that, it was basically a message to the membership of the PQ, say, look, we need to all class together to make that option possible, to make separation possible. But on the other hand, the PQ didn't want to talk about sovereignty this election. They did want to talk about a good government election. Mm-hmm. And so, but these contradictions were already present. Already the left was seeing Quebec solidaire, taking a left stand and questioning their own party policies and with the austerities measure that the PQ have just taken, you know, in a year and a half. And on the other hand, already the PQ was on one hand talking to a space about sovereignty and on the public sphere saying something different. So mm-hmm. the malaise was already there.
Mm-hmm. But it did play an impact in terms of one of the trade union federations moving their support to Quebec Solidaire, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But I think it was not only Pierre Carl Perlodeau that pushed that. Quebec Solidaire was presenting a lot of union leaders into his candidate and having a series of proposals to support unions and unionization of different sector. As the opposite, the PQ was taking different stand against unions and taking a series of austerity measure that the unions workers' unions were fighting against. So there was all the context, I think. But of course, Pierre Capaldo was just the drop that make everything débordé. Sorry for the word.
yeah. So in terms of the looking at having a Liberal government with such a large majority, as someone that was active in the student strike movement, what will be the impact of that on the demands of the students raised?
Well, this is a big question and a very good one. Because on one hand, just a year and a half ago, we were basically doing party over the end of Chara's era, the last Liberal government. And now, here we go, they are re-elected. But we already had a cold shower with the PQ. So the movement can draw two conclusions, a very cynical one, saying, see, there is no possibilities, nothing is working, let's not do anything, basically. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, a lot of people lost their semester, maybe put their career in a problematic situation. A lot of people make depression. It was a very difficult moment. Some people went out with that with a lot of debt too, because it was during a year, you know, it was demanding a lot from all the people in the street. Some other are in jail right now for that, and here we go, the balls is again there. So it's true, it's discouraging. On the other hand, this is a good news, because about the PQ, a lot of illusion was still going in the population into the left movements about this party being left or having some kind of a favorable prejudice towards left position in social democracy. But now we know it's false. We already knew it for a lot, but some other didn't. And on the other hand, it showed the need for a street opposition, because it's not only by voting every 4 years that you can really change the thing. It's by the action in the street. So it certainly reinforced the option of militancy in the street.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that I wondered is, I know that liberals, before being defeated previously, were looking at doing things like decreasing the support for childcare, and those, that was also, aside from the student movement, concerns within the women's movement was another reason for their original defeat. What do you think the impact of these election results will be for women?
Well, first thing is the PQ, unfortunately, did exactly the same thing than the Liberal. They actually increased the amount, $7 daycare to $9, and were cutting in, like, for example, welfare and other programs for women. So for the women's movements, it's a bit the same question than for the student movement and basically for all movement, because on the economic sector and social sectors, PQs and Liberals were having exactly the same agenda. Even if during the election the PQ seemed left, when we got them on power, it was the same, exactly the same. So for the women's movement, again, well, first there is, I think, the women's movement, they need to recover from the crisis with the charter of value, because feminism was a lot used to say it's the reason why we need to fight against VL, and it create quite sharp arguments into the movement. So there is, I think, this aspect of reviewing anti-racism into the women's movement. Mm. But about the government being elected, the new government, it certainly, again, for them too, reinforced the need for action in the street and not just wishing that a good government would be elected.
And what do you think in the weeks to come there in Quebec?
Well, I think there is there will be, the map will be reorganized, I think, for the different political force. And a lot can change for Quebec solo there. First thing is the PQ now need to redefine itself. Are they going to be a party where they will fight for the option of sovereignty right now, a bit like Option National was doing, but the Option National vote also dropped de façon significante. Mm-hmm. And if they decide to take that position, well, it means that the PQ will not be expected to be taking the power in the next election. It will be more a fight between CAQ and Liberals. But in that case, if the PQ take this option, it means that they did want to make the promotion to sovereignty, and so it put them in a different situation. If this is happening, probably also they will have to take a more social democrat outlook to things and let a right-wing an agenda for the bourgeoisie. This will cost to Quebec Solidaire, because probably we can see in that situation part of the membership of Quebec Solidaire going towards PQ. But if PQ actually prefer to go towards more the good government agenda kind of option, in this case they will have to drop their more like their militant aspect of sovereignty. And in this case, we'll see probably Option National, Quebec Solidaire, getting people from the PQ towards them. But in that circumstance, it will reinforce, unfortunately, the nationalist aspect of Quebec Solidaire. Well, unfortunately, that's my point of view. For some, it would be good. Yeah. But Quebec Solidaire is also in question to see because are they going to go towards reinforcing the left position and their left agenda, or towards more a little bit like the PQ of 1976, a left and sovereignist, so reinforcing the sovereignist aspect of it. That's a question also for QS.
And that was Marianne Breton-Fontaine.
Well, that's our show for Democracy North, the best interviews, headlines, and music from this week on Media Mornings. I'm David Ball. You can find us at w2media.ca/thisweek. Thank you for listening.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independent like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
The landscape of change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
and podcasting at w2media.ca.